fallout. You know, interestingly, Donald Trump, who, you know, is very articulate about a lot of subjects, has not ever really explained why. He has said to, you know, campaign operatives around him, who did say back in 2014 when Virginia Roberts first sort of surfaced with her public claims about Epstein, that that he had severed ties with him when Epstein had come after a daughter of a member of Mar-a-Lago. There is also reportedly a dispute, there was a dispute between the two men over a piece of real estate near Palm Beach that both men wanted, and that Donald Trump ultimately ended up getting at a bankruptcy auction and then flipped at a massive profit a couple of years later. But he's never actually talked about that in public. He has just said, you know, he's just distanced himself.
We have 10 seconds, but we're going to continue with the post show with you, because it's really critical to talk about what are these files the MAGA base and many Democrats and Republicans have called for releasing. Vicki Ward, longtime investigative journalist, host of the series Chasing Ghislaine.
Lock your wigs, let the air out of your shoes, and prepare yourselves for a period of simulated exhilaration.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
There's something curious about this broadcast.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Trump administration is targeting the Oregon Department of Education.
Oregon registered nurse Melanie Wagner has health advice for Oregonians experiencing wildfire smoke.
And earlier this month, over 250 Venezuelans were sent back to Venezuela for the El Salvador prison known as CICOT.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 28th, 2025. I'm Cheryl Denise.
And I'm Dave Johnson. Monday, there was a hearing trial for a local pacifist Quaker who was arrested and detained from his home on Friday morning. According to a personal account from his partner in a Facebook post, they were sleeping in bed when, quote, a flood of armed officers raced into their driveway and charged at their house with assault rifles. The federal officers banged on the door and pointed guns at them through the window, telling them to open the door when he asked if they had a warrant. Jacob's partner was told that Jacob was being detained for assaulting a federal officer at an ICE protest. Though his partner declined to make direct comments about the event, as it is an open case, they said that Jacob is, quote, a pacifist Quaker who is the most compassionate, loving, gentle person I have ever met. On Monday, July 28th, there was a gathering outside the Department of Justice. As Jacob had his hearing, there was about 60 to 100 people gathered there. City Councilors Angelita Murillo and Mitch Green were both present. Samir Cannell went into the hearing to witness it. Among other people present was Nick Caleb of Breach Collective, Susie and Pedro, who wrote the petition to revoke the ICE permits in Portland, many members of Southwest Indivisible, Cherise Bach of 350 PDX, and many members of the Quaker community. Jacob is one of among many who have been detained in this struggle. Jacob Hoops will be released today at 5 p.m. Many are not as lucky. As his partner said in her Facebook post, quote, he and I also recognize the privilege we hold in being white, able-bodied people living in a nice neighborhood. If our bodies looked different, or if we lived with a different zip code, our situation could have been much worse. Deadly, end quote. Though Jacob Hoops will be released today, he has a trial date set in the future.
The U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights is targeting the Oregon Department of Education. It's in regard to the alleged violations of Title IX, a federal law that prohibits sex-based discrimination in schools. The U.S. Education Department announced this morning that civil rights investigators will look into allegations that Oregon has allowed transgender females to compete in women's sports. Federal investigators opened the probe after the conservative nonprofit America First Policy Institute first filed a complaint. Acting Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights Craig Traynor said, quote, the Trump administration will not allow educational institutions that receive federal funds to continue trampling upon women's rights, end quote. The U.S. complaint alleged that multiple high school female athletes in Oregon missed out on awards due to Oregon policies allowing transgender high school students to participate in competitions for female athletes. State education officials follow Oregon law, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender identity. Oregon state guidance, just updated in March, states, quote, schools are prohibited from excluding gender-expansive students from participating in school athletics and activities that align with their consistently asserted gender identity if the basis of such exclusion is the student's gender identity, end quote. The U.S. Education Department contends that federal law overrides state law. This follows directives made in Donald Trump's Keeping Men Out of Women's Sports executive order from February. A variety of state education departments, school districts, athletic associations, and colleges across the country have been targeted over policies governing transgender student athletes.
As Pacific Northwest summer continues, so do the fires. As of yesterday, Sunday, the 27th of July, the Cram Fire in eastern Oregon was declared 100% contained. It reached over 95,000 acres. Burdoin Fire level in southern Washington near White Salmon and just across the Columbia from Hood River has calmed considerably. As of Monday, the fire burned over 11,000 acres, had burned 44 structures, and is 54% contained. All of the evacuation levels in the surrounding areas have been lowered. There are three levels to a fire evacuation. Level one is a standard warning that you should be aware that there is an imminent possible danger. Level two is an order to have all your things prepared to leave at any moment. And level three is the, quote, go now level, means that you must leave the area as quickly as possible. All three go now level three areas have been lowered to a level two threat, and all areas that were previously at level one threat are no longer under a threat. The Burdoin fire forced about 900 people to evacuate their homes. A large swath of the southeastern Oregon, from Crater Lake all the way to the east of the Nevada state line, is under fire warning watch, and some areas are in red flag warnings.
As wildfires and extreme weather events increase across Oregon, the state is turning to microgrids to provide communities with reliable, renewable energy. New legislation is designed to stimulate construction across the state. Isabel Charlie has more on the story.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has signed into law the first set of statewide policies in the country supporting community-owned microgrids. Microgrids are local, self-contained energy systems that use renewable energy sources such as wind or solar power. Dylan Cruz of Sustainable Northwest, a nonprofit involved in drafting the legislation, says microgrids can help mitigate the uptick in power outages caused by wildfires and extreme weather, especially in rural parts of the state.
We're seeing an increased interest from small towns, from communities, from tribes, saying, look, if the lights go out, we need to have options so we can continue to provide emergency services. We can provide communications.
Microgrids can power critical facilities such as hospitals or fire stations, operating either connected to the main grid or independently during emergencies. Joshua Bassafin with Climate Solutions says that while some microgrids are being developed in Oregon alongside utility companies, they are most valuable when communities reap the economic and resiliency benefits.
When communities own those systems themselves, they actually have the ability to control those microgrids as they need for their own purposes.
Oregon's new law requires the State Public Utility Commission to establish clear rules for the operation and ownership of community microgrids, which Cruz believes will expedite their construction. He says while other states have considered moving in this direction, Oregon is the first to take this step.
This legislation is the most ambitious, comprehensive legislation in the country of its kind.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson blasts effort to release more Epstein files. A bill advances in the U.S. House to strip chemical regulators from the EPA. Montana students join a lawsuit for Election Day voting rights, while a Mississippi court decision should lead to more transparency on public defender resources. With that story and more, it's Zamon Perez with 2025 Talks.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has
welcome
signed
to 2025
into law the
Talks,
set of
where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Community-owned microgrids.
It would require. The DOJ to release more files on late financier and pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Kentucky Republican Thomas Massie and California Democrat Ro Khanna are co-sponsoring a discharge petition that looks to have the votes to pass. Johnson is also slamming Democrats on the House Rules Committee for forcing votes on making justice turnover investigation materials. He says they're using hundreds of Epstein's victims for political gain, but refuses to comment on the possibility that President Donald Trump might pardon Epstein's imprisoned girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell. The House Appropriations Committee has advanced a so-called cancer gag bill that would, in effect, limit pesticide makers' liability for possible carcinogens. Rebecca Wolf with Food and Water Watch says similar relabeling legislation died in the Iowa legislature in spite of intense lobbying from chemical company Bayer.
So this is part of a nationwide effort that we've been seeing that is trying to block the ability for people to protect their health.
Bayer makes the herbicide Roundup and has spent more than $11 billion to settle cancer lawsuits. Montana young people are suing over voting rights. In spite of the state Supreme Court striking down a law banning same-day voter registration, lawmakers just passed another that cuts those hours and limits voting with student IDs. Attorney Molly Danahy is representing youth groups, including Forward Montana, in a suit against the Secretary of State.
Young voters, especially new voters, are more likely to use or rely on Election Day registration because they may be becoming eligible or deciding to vote later in the process than the regular voters.
Republicans back the measure, saying it'll ease the burden on election officials. Opponents say there are better ways to cut their workload, including better equipment and more poll workers. Mississippi is one of only a few states without some kind of statewide public defender system, relying instead on a county-level patchwork, marked by inconsistency and poor transparency. But the state Supreme Court has ordered counties to make their public defense plans publicly available. Veteran civil rights lawyer Cliff Johnson says that's good news for low-income defendants who rely on public defenders across the Magnolia State.
I'm excited about what I expect we'll see, and I think it's going to be good news for courts, for the speedy resolution of cases, for defendants, for public safety. I think it's going to be good news for people who are victims.
A new poll from Marquette shows promise for billionaire and former Trump advisor Elon Musk's pledge to form the new America Party. 40% of Republicans and a quarter of Democrats say they would consider supporting it. Musk says the way the budget mega bill explodes the deficit and cuts renewable energy is motivating him to start the new party. The U.S. and the European Union have reached a trade deal, setting tariffs at 15%. Trump says the EU will buy $750 billion of energy from the U.S. and will invest $600 billion more here. I'm Zimon Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for an in-depth interview with psychologist and artist Dr. Diane Kaufman. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be warm, a high for the day of 87 around now, and a low of 58 degrees tonight. And tomorrow, it will be a high of 92 and a low of 61 degrees. Today in 1869, a women's shoemakers in Lynn, Massachusetts demanded equal pay and formed the first National Women's Union. The quote of the day is from political activist, author, and academic Angela Davis. She said, quote, "I am no longer accepting the things I cannot change. I'm changing the things I cannot accept."
Officials with the Mescalero Apache tribe in New Mexico recently told state lawmakers during an interim legislative meeting that they're concerned about the impact of potential cuts to federal law enforcement on the reservation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Dwayne Duffy estimates that there could be a 20 to 30% decrease.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Mescalero Apache leaders recently told New Mexico state lawmakers they're concerned about possible federal funding cuts to law enforcement. Jeanette Didios has more.
The Economic and Rural Development and Policy Committee held its interim hearing in Mescalero, New Mexico. Vice President.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Mescalero Apache leaders recently told New Mexico state lawmakers they're concerned about possible federal funding cuts to law enforcement. Jeanette Didios has more.
The Economic and Rural Development and Policy Committee held its interim hearing in Mescalero, New Mexico. Vice President of the Mescalero Apache Tribe, Dwayne Duffy, estimates that there could be a 20 to 30% decrease in federal funding for law enforcement based on the proposed budget from the White House. He says this is concerning because the tribe relies completely on federal funding to pay for its law enforcement.
The federal government just built a brand new detention facility on our reservation, and they're still trying to staff that. And, you know, the question is, are those federal cuts, are they going to affect whether or not they're going to be able to open that facility? And so they'll have a federal facility sitting there as a shell vacant until they can fully staff it.
The tribal nation makes up 463,000 acres, and it relies on 6 Bureau of Indian Affairs law enforcement officers. President of the Mescalero Apache tribe, Thora Padilla, says even losing one officer could be detrimental.
So any kind of cut's going to really impact us, and it's difficult to try to stretch those resources over the 24-hour period that we have to protect our people with.
Duffy says he and Padilla will be having further discussions with both the federal and state delegations to work on filling the gaps from future cuts. I'm Jeanette Didios.
The Trump administration wants to eliminate the federal agency that's helped Alaska villages develop infrastructure with more than $2 billion over the decades. Ayulna Naiden with the Alaska Desk reports on how likely the government is to cut the Denali Commission and who would stand to lose.
The cut is in the Trump administration's budget proposal for the federal fiscal year that begins in October. It is an effort to curtail what they call taxpayer waste and reduce the federal role in local economic development. Julie Kipka is the federal co-chair at the Denali Commission. She says previous administrations have made similar proposals, and she's optimistic about the commission continuing its work.
We take it seriously, but we're very hopeful that we'll be identified and funded in the appropriations process.
The president's skinny budget outlines the administration's funding priorities, but Congress has the final say, expected in legislation in September or later. Congress created the Denali Commission in 1998 to work in partnership with the federal government, state, and tribes to address rural Alaska's needs. Since then, the agency has been helping villages develop power generation facilities, transportation infrastructure, and water and sewer systems. It has also provided job training and funded over 150 rural health clinics.
We have priority on small and distressed communities environmentally threatened.
The administration said it wants to cut the Denali Commission because states understand their local issues best and can address them more effectively. The state of Alaska is already a partner and a co-chair on the Denali Commission. Overall, Kitka says Alaska is growing in national and international importance, and she believes the administration will recognize the infrastructure needs in a state in such a strategic location.
There is really important work that needs to be done in our state for the resilience of our communities and our people to deal with the challenges that are just growing. Warming of the Arctic and increased transit, the access for natural resources, trade.
Kitka says she will continue working with the House and Senate to make the case for the commission. I am Alona Naiden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
More than 250 Venezuelans who were sent to El Salvador after being accused without evidence of being in the Trinidad Aragua gang were just released as part of a prisoner exchange between the U.S. and Venezuela. Over the last several months, the Trump administration sent hundreds of Venezuelans to El Salvador prison, known as the Terrorism Confinement Center, CECOT. These people were abducted from their homes and life, living in cells with no privacy, sleeping on metal sheets set up like bunk beds. For almost 4 months, no one's identity was released by the U.S. government, and no one was allowed to call a lawyer or a family member. A prison warden told 19-year-old Carlos Daniel Terran that he would never leave the mega prison. Terran immigrated to the United States legally as part of the Biden-era CPP-1 program. He has no criminal record in the U.S., and like all of the Venezuelans abducted to El Salvador, denies any gang affiliation. El Salvador's own justice minister said earlier this year that the only way to leave the mega prison was in a coffin. Three people that NPR has been following described the violence perpetrated by the guards in detail in the NPR article. Cristososal is an organization that their mission is, quote, to defend human rights and promote democratic rule of law in Central America. Cristosal has come forward to say that the kind of violence used against these in the prison qualifies as torture. The Trump administration continues to assert that these people are violent criminals, despite giving no evidence themselves and going against mounting evidence that they are indeed not criminals. Some of the Venezuelans documented citizens of the United States. Executive Director of Cristosal, Noah Bullock, conducted background checks of 160 of the 252 Venezuelans sent to El Salvador and found that only 10% had criminal records. This reporting was informed by Sergio Martinez Beltran and Manuel Ruida of National Public Radio.
Itamar Greenberg is one of many young Israeli Jews to accept 6 months in prison instead of participating in the Israeli genocide in Gaza. In Israel, men must serve at least 32 months in the army, while women must serve at least 24 months. Israeli Arabs, religious women, married individuals, and those deemed medically or mentally unfit or exempt from compulsory military service, the IDF says on its website. A group of refusers burned their IDF draft papers at a rally in Tel Aviv. Itamar says that While the refusal movement is growing, there is immense fear on being shunned by society and even disowned from their own families. Itamar says that a friend of his had almost refused, but after his family threatened to kick him out, he joined the IDF. Itamar spoke of another friend who serves in the IDF and is, quote, not a leftist. He says the friend recently messaged into a group chat, quote, I don't know how to say it, but it started to look like we're doing genocide. In the last few weeks, devastating hunger has hit Palestine, killing dozens of children. Palestinian health officials say the IDF has killed more than 62,000 Palestinians since October 7th, 2023, soon after the Hamas-led attacks killed around 1,200 Israelis and saw 250 taken hostage, according to Israeli figures. This was informed by reporting by The Intercept.
Donald Trump is threatening to hold up a new stadium deal if Washington's NFL team does not restore its name to what many consider a racial slur. This comes following decades of research showing there are negative mental health impacts when teams have Native American mascots, particularly for children. Mark Macaro, president of the National Congress of American Indians, an organization that has been pushing back on stereotypes of Native Americans since the 1950s, said, quote, this is a big reminder that this administration that we're going to take some backward steps. We have our studies, we have our receipts, and we can demonstrate that this causes real harm, end quote. Specifically, the use of Native mascots can lead to the heightened rates of depression, self-harm, substance abuse, and suicidal ideation among indigenous peoples. Trump allegedly believes that franchises who change their names to, quote, pander to the woke left should immediately restore their original name, according to a White House statement. Davis Engel, a spokesperson for the administration, said, quote, thanks to President Trump, the days of political correctness and cancel culture are over, end quote. Under pressure from decades of activism, the Washington Redskins retired that name in 2020, eventually settling on the name Commanders. Later that year, the Cleveland Indians changed their name to the Guardians. The D.C. Council is set to hold its first vote on a deal to build a new football stadium for the team. Popular arguments defending the mascots have been that they honor Native people or that the teams have qualities recognized as being positive, like bravery and strength. But others say the names are slurs or represent stereotypes. They reinforce racial prejudices among non-Natives, even in the healthcare workers and teachers. And we now have decades of data that demonstrate negative mental health impacts. Stephanie Freiberg, a professor at Northwestern University, who is a member of the Tulalip tribes and one of the country's leading researchers on Native mascots, has done work showing that Native mascots increase the risk of real psychological harm, especially for young Native people. Freiberg said, quote, honoring Native peoples means being ending dehumanization in both imagery and policy. Indian country needs meaningful investment, respect, and the restoration of federal commitments, not more distractions or excuses for inaction, end quote.
Governor Tina Kotek declared a state of emergency on July 16th, citing the growing threat of Oregon wildfire season. Now is the time for residents to prepare for smoke-related health impacts and take steps to minimize exposure. Melanie Wagner, a registered nurse and Oregon Associate Vice President of Health Engagement Strategies at United Healthcare, has some health advice for Oregonians during this time. KBOO's Hannah Francis has more.
So I am a registered nurse by trade, and my background is emergency room and trauma nursing. So, you know, when you're in the emergency room, you work with a lot of individuals who have respiratory issues, and you see firsthand how things like respiratory pollutants or air pollution can exacerbate those situations.
Yeah, absolutely. Really important work.
So can you tell me about some of the main health implications of wildfire smoke?
Absolutely. So when you have wildfires, the smoke mixes with the particles in the air, and basically it creates pollutants that enter the lungs. So kind of when you think about, pollution from gas or from environmental factors, it really works the same way. And so there's kind of two main implications. So you have your healthier population that really doesn't have respiratory issues, and they can struggle, maybe more on a minor scale. So things like itchy eyes, tickle in your throat, a small cough, those kind of things. But then when you have individuals who are highly sensitive, so if you think about people who have lung disorders like COPD or asthma, and even those with some heart conditions, it really can make breathing very, very difficult for them. It can exacerbate those situations and even put them in the emergency room or the hospital. And in those cases, they may experience things like tightness in their chest, severe shortness of air, and even some respiratory failure.
Right. So what are some ways that folks can reduce their exposure?
Great question. Really, first and foremost, it's all about just avoiding the irritants. And so ways that we can do that, trying to limit the time that you're spending outdoors can be super helpful. So when you think about, maybe being inside, having clean air filters, maybe having a room of your house that, is void of any other kind of internal pollutants, things like cigarette smoke, candles, those things can even contribute to inside air pollution. So making sure that you have a room, particularly your sleeping room, that is free of those. And then, of course, we do have individuals in the community that have to get out. They have to work in the environment. And so for those individuals, it may be important that they wear something like an N95 tight fitting mask when they're out doing their daily activities. And then the other thing I would probably caution about is, I know that we have a lot of outdoor warriors that love to get out in Oregon, but really limiting exercise to maybe indoor when we have those high air quality alert days can be super helpful so that we're not exacerbating any kind of lung issues that they might be experiencing.
Are there certain alerts that folks can look for?